So good morning, everyone, and nice to be back. I had a very nice month off from teaching. However, in the last week, my whole family has gotten a cold. It's kind of, you know, one of these family system kind of things that goes through, and it's my turn. And I'm at the tail end of it, but there's still a little bit lingering in the head. So if I'm not intelligible today, raise your hand or something, and I'll try to make amends. Some way. It was very nice to be able to be kind of a sabbatical and did a lot of sitting, not as much as I hoped, but I certainly stopped all my usual activities of teaching, and it was, I think, very significant for me to stop all that. And I realized the first week or so how much momentum I had with all the teaching activities I do, kind of momentum in my mind. And so it was nice to kind of put that all to a stop. And it was strange to think about coming back to start teaching again, even after a month, because by the end of the month, I had forgotten I had anything to teach. So that was a little bit awkward then to come back and have to teach something, maybe. And I don't know if I said this on Sunday. I think I said it on Monday before I left in January. I just wanted to name the people who made it possible for me to take my sabbatical, just out of gratitude. And because I got a grant that was given through Spirit Rock for Spirit Rock teachers, and that grant came from Newman's Own Organics. So if you've ever bought their pretzels or something, you were supporting my sabbatical. And then there's some announcements for me to make. This Wednesday morning, we have a half-day sitting that I'll be leading from 9:30 to 12:15, and then this Wednesday evening, start a three-week Wednesday evening series that I've titled "Dying in the Dharma," with the idea being that a lot of us who have kind of made Buddhism and Vipassana very central to our lives, as we approach our deaths or as loved ones die, we'd like to know how you would die or the resources that are available. From a Buddhist perspective, for this major transition. And so the goal of this class is to offer that. And then this Saturday, Terry Lesser is going to offer a yoga and meditation half day from 9:30 to 1. And then today also is the temple cleaning day. But every other Sunday, those of you who'd like to stay behind and a little bit after the Dharma talk and help be stewards, take care of the of our center and help with some of the cleaning and some of the yard work. It's really wonderful that people do that, and it's usually a nice group of people that work together. And you can meet, if you're interested in that, you can meet over there by the window to the kitchen and the passageway there to the kitchen, and it'll get organized. So, well, since I'm going to do this series on having to do with dying, starting on Wednesday, I think that's probably one of the reasons why what has been in my mind the last couple of days is issues related to that. And the topic of samsara has come up for me. And I wanted to spend a few minutes, as I did yesterday, talking about the classic view of samsara in Buddhism, for those of you who might not know it. And then to see if there's ways of applying that understanding or adapting that understanding to our lives today. The image of samsara, the idea of samsara, is one of the very powerful ideas of classic Buddhism. The word samsara means something like, or literally something like, to wander on and on and on, to wander. To roam on and on and on, to be running on and on and on. And in ancient India, before Buddhism, there were various theories about the human predicament, about human life and what it's all about. Just like most religions have different addresses the issue of the human problem of suffering in life and what happens with death and what happens after death. And in Vedic times, 1,000 years before the Buddha, There was a very kind of, apparently kind of a general idea that when people die, they go to some place. And that place was considered to be okay to go to. Maybe a place of the elders or, I don't know if it was exactly understood to be a heaven, but a place. And then as some of the shamanic or some of the renunciant traditions of India were developing, they developed ideas of, some of them had developed ideas of rebirth, that in fact we don't just simply go off into some other world, but beings get reborn, and that cycles of rebirth happens over and over again. There were other traditions at the same time who didn't believe that. And there was one tradition in the time of the Buddha, the materialists, who believed that when we die, that's it. There's no continuation beyond this particular life. So there were a diversity of ideas floating around India at the time of the Buddha. And the Buddha belonged to that tradition that believed in rebirth. And the Buddha's teachings on rebirth is that there was no discernible beginning to the process of rebirth. There's no first beginning, first point where it all started. It's not like the Big Bang. It just starts from the Big Bang and then it goes from there. You can't find the beginning. And in the same way, for people who are roaming on, who are wandering on, there is no discernible end to this process. And so he had a lot of similes or analogies for this process. And one of them is that, a very powerful one, is that the amount of tears that you have shed in your endless wandering through samsara exceeds all the water in all the oceans. So that's quite a bit of time. There is another one where he says, in modern terms, he would say you take a plant chipper to all the plant material in the whole world, all the trees and bushes and grass and everything, and chip it up into small pieces, and you make a big mound of this plant material. And for every one of your ancestors, you know, your mother, your grandmother, your great-grandmother, you go back in time, you move, you take one chip away from this pile. Well, your ancestors are greater than that mound of chips. It goes that far back. And then to emphasize again this kind of infinity of time in which people are wandering through samsara. Samsara is not exactly kind of a place. Sometimes it's treated like a place. But samsara is like this wandering on and on. If you take a cubic granite that's the size of, that's 1 mile square, and every 100 years a person comes by that granite and brushes a soft silk scarf from Varanasi against that granite, the amount of time it would take to wear down that granite to dust is one kalpa, one aeon. And we've been going through, wandering through this endless rounds of rebirth for not 1,000, not 100,000, not 100 million, but an infinite amount of these eons, these kalpas. So you get kind of a sense, they're trying to make this image of this endless time of being reborn. And perhaps there was kind of a strategy here in this kind of strong imagery was to really drive into people maybe the futility or the suffering, the pain of this endless recycling, so that people would want to stop being recycled. Human beings, you know, the human body is the ultimate recycled machine. Right? We're all made up of recycled parts. Well, the human psyche also, the human consciousness, is endless recycling itself through this cycles of birth and birth, death, and rebirth. The Buddha's contribution to this idea, an ancient Indian idea of rebirth, is that the mechanism or the impulse, the fuel for moving through the cycles of rebirth is greed, hate, and delusion. That the human consciousness, the human mind, has a certain momentum in it through the activities we engage in, through activities of greed, activities of hate, of delusion. And it puts a kind of spin, momentum of the, on the consciousness that then, at the moment of death, causes that consciousness, in a sense, to move forward into the next life. It's kind of like, you know, if you've had a habit formation of always wanting, wanting, wanting in your life, that wanting doesn't simply just evaporate when you die, but that wanting momentum is still there. It's kind of like you've been sent forth into the next life with that wanting. And it latches on to the next life. But if there's no wanting momentum of the mind, then the mind will not reach forward to grab onto the next life. And in Buddhist terminology, then you're liberated from this endless cycles of rebirth. And the same thing with aversion, if that momentum is there. And it's very easy to see that. As I mentioned in my little introduction, I saw the momentum of my mind when I started my sabbatical. It wasn't so easy to just stop it like that. It's still, you know, my concerns, my thoughts would keep going on. And probably most of you coming to sit here this morning, probably your mind is suddenly stop and turn itself off, and you are sitting very peacefully. Maybe you were, but chances you are aware a little bit of the momentum of your mind and how your mind has a mind of its own. And it's not so easy necessarily to stop it that quickly. The momentum is there. So then the theory in Buddhism is that the same momentum then continues, is the fuel, is the cause for continuing rebirth. If that desire, the momentum wasn't there, there would be no further rebirth. So why isn't it good news that we're endlessly reborn? And some people are quite happy with being alive, and they think being alive is great, and the idea of the fact that life doesn't end with death seems like a very good thing, and means you get to have a second chance, and a third chance, and a hundredth chance. Kind of Groundhog Day, endlessly, right? Kind of trying to make it work out. And I don't know exactly the reason why ancient Indians felt, or modern ones also, sometimes Buddhists all over Asia and in America, feel so strongly the motivation to get off the wheel. But part of it is that they see that this world, this life, is inherently has more suffering in it than is desirable to experience. And so some of the analogies the Buddha gave then is that the number of times that you've seen your mother die, you know, is endless. It's part of each, you know. And so just to go through that again, to go through the suffering of life over and over again. And our society in America, to some degree, hides or is not as cognizant, I think, of the amount of suffering that is inherent in human life. We sometimes pretty over suffering, or certainly modern medicine has made some of the suffering that's been traditionally part of human life not so prevalent as it has been. Many places in the world, as it was in this country just some decades ago, a lot of people died in childbirth, both the mother and the child. And many places in the world, people don't live beyond the age of 5, as it was in this country just some while ago. And so when people kind of experience this kind of endless suffering, as I said yesterday, I went to the little country store, the museum in Woodside, the post office, and I have an exhibit of how it was like 20, 30 years ago there in the store. And the guy who started was the dentist, the town dentist in Woodside. And it talks in a little exhibit of how dangerous it was to go to the dentist back then, because they didn't know about bacteria. They didn't know about infection. And so if they needed a pair of pliers to pull your teeth out, they would go to the barn and just, you know, sitting there next to the, you know, whatever, and just, you know, take it out of the barn and put it in your mouth and pull your tooth out, and then you get gangrene and you die from going to the dentist. It wasn't always the case, but so I think being cognizant of the suffering that was so much part of life, people thought it was desirable to somehow get off this wheel. And in the Indian mind, the idea of getting off was not an end. In the Buddhism, the fate of an enlightened person when they die is indescribable, and it's not something to be talked about. The Buddha refused to say that an enlightened person comes to a final end when they die, like that's it, but refused to say there's any continuation of the person, refused to say that there's both continuation and non-continuation, and refuse to say there's not continuation nor not continuation. All the different ways of talking about the enlightened person when they die is simply not interesting. But somehow, it was somehow wonderful, glorious, something special, something to look forward to, this idea of stepping off the wheel. So that's kind of the classic view, which motivates still a lot of people in their Buddhist practice. I was very inspired when I went to Thailand and spent some time with Ajahn Buddhadasa and with his teaching. He was one of the great teachers of Thailand in the last century, great partly because of his great influence in Thai culture and Thai Buddhism. And what was happening in Thailand was that many of the Thais who were being educated, getting kind of modern education, were feeling somewhat turned off by what they thought as being the superstitious and supernatural aspects of Thai Buddhism. And but then Buddhadasa came along and offered what he called, or what has been called, a demythologized view of Buddhism that then suddenly inspired a lot of the educated Thais in their native Buddhism. And kind of they found themselves very inspired by their Buddhist practice and Buddhist religion. And one of the ways that he demythologized Buddhism, he didn't exactly negate the classical teachings, but he offered an alternative or second view on how to understand some of them. And with the idea of rebirth, being reborn, the endless cycles of rebirth, he offered another way of understanding this, and this is you understand it as the mind gets recycled, reborn, moment by moment, day by day, in the various states of being that happens in the cycles of rebirth. There are five or six states of being that consciousnesses can get reborn in the classic view. Human beings is just one. There's also you can be reborn in the animal realm. You can be reborn in the hell realms. You can be reborn in the hungry ghost realms. You can be reborn in the heavenly realms. That's five. And sometimes people add the sixth one, which is the realm of the asuras, which are sometimes called the jealous titans or the jealous gods. They're kind of like gods, but they're jealous. Jealous of the other gods. And they're fighting against the gods, trying to take over the heavens. And the chances of getting reborn as a human being are really minuscule. And if you knew, it's like winning the lottery. You know, not many people win the lottery. The way it's classically described is if you take a log, it has a hole in it, and it's floating in the ocean, and you have a blind tortoise that's swimming in the ocean. And if that blind tortoise, once every 100 years, tries to surface in the ocean through the hole in that log, the chance of being reborn as a human being is the chances of that turtle, blind turtle, making its way up through that log floating around the world. You understand the analogy? So it's not something like winning the lottery, right? So your chances of being reborn in some of these other realms are much more likely. If you spend a lot of time, the momentum of your mind is the momentum of desire, that's when you're living your life, then you're more likely to be reborn as a hungry ghost, where that's kind of the nature of a hungry ghost, is they have this insatiable desire. And no matter how much they consume, they'll never get satisfied. They always want more and more. If you spend a lifetime of being afraid or confused, that tends to then to be the conditions to be born as an animal. In the classic view, animals are considered to be characterized by fear and confusion. And if you are filled with hate and violence, then you tend to be reborn in the hell realms. And if you live a very virtuous life and have wonderful, blissful spiritual experiences, then you're more likely to be born in the heavenly realms. So Ajahn Buddhadasa turned this around or offered this other view and said this happens moment by moment in our own mind, that there are times where we get consumed by desire, and the desire can be insatiable. And that moment, those moments, those minutes, those days, and that happens, then we have entered into the hell realms. And no matter how much we consume, we don't feel satiated, we don't get enough. And this is very descriptive of people who have addictions, for example. Or in a sense, addictions is less and less satisfying the more we get and get and get. And there's kind of endless cycles of sometimes addictions leaving us empty, wanting more pleasure, like, you know, for alcohol or food or whatever, and leaving us kind of empty, and we want more to fill it. And I went through a period with food where I would grasp for food to comfort myself. The food made me worse when I overdid it. I had actually a wheat allergy, and I was kind of led to kind of addiction to wheat, paradoxically, oddly enough. And so I would comfort myself to want more, eat more wheat, more bread and stuff. I was working in a bakery, so I had lots of access to food, to bread. So I'd eat these baguettes, and then I'd feel worse. And then to comfort myself, I would try to eat more. Mm-hmm. And then I would comfort myself and feel worse. And it was a cycle until finally I just, you know, I felt I was ready. Really, I felt like I didn't want to talk to anyone because I felt if I talked, I couldn't talk, and they would probably send me off to an asylum. My mind was just so numb from this process of having some allergy, at least. But this addictive process that was part of it. And so the wanting, the insatiable wanting we can sometimes have. And then there's the, if we filled with hate or anger. Sometimes we talk about being, you know, on fire, hot with anger. And then we're in the hot hells. Or if it's a frozen anger, I call resentment frozen anger. And then maybe it's the cold hells. In Buddhism, there's classic view, there's cold and hot hells. So we get reborn in these things moment by moment, depending how we're feeling. If we're filled with fear, then we're in the animal realms in that moment, perhaps. Virtuous lives, people who feel the security, the safety, the bliss of living virtuous lives and clean lives, who are able to kind of access to spiritual experiences, get reborn in the heavenly realms. And this also can happen, you know, in daily life and moment by moment in various ways. So then, then Buddhadasa said, you know, also then we translated this classic view to say that what perpetuates in this cycle of cycling through these is the very same thing that cycles us through the cycles of rebirth, is that the moment-to-moment cycles of the mind have to do with momentum of greed, hate, and delusion. The momentum, the reaching forward, the grasping, the wanting of the mind, the aversion of the mind, the hate of the mind. And the mind has this momentum in it, this spin on it. And it's possible to stop that spin, to step off the wheel. And a lot of the trust of Buddhist practice then, both in the classic sense and this sense of Buddhadasa, is to step off the cycles of endless cycling, this treadmill that goes on and on and on, that has no beginning and has no end. Part of the value of understanding it has no beginning is that the quest to understand the original cause of why I'm doing this way is a pointless task. The original cause cannot be found. Samsara has no beginning. The beginning of your desire, there is no first cause in your desire. Perhaps, in modern terms, we would say we're simply born with it. It's maybe genetic almost. It's when we're born with desire. It's not because your parents treated you a certain way that you have this problem with desire. You know, to go back and find the first original cause is not something that can be found. So, and other people have taken this demon, what can be called, vocabulary to use, demythologized version, because people believe in the mythologies, or those, you know, they feel a little bit insulted then, because they don't see it as mythology. But this rationalized alternative, or something, this humanist alternative, or this, I don't know what to call it, the immediacy of this, the mental alternative, understanding it as being how the mind works moment by moment. Maybe it's a better way of saying it. Chögyam Trungpa offered the same teaching in this 1970s in his book, a great title, Spiritual Materialism, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. my mind is going back to thinking about this idea of addiction and the great contribution that AA has made to this whole issue of addiction in America, and how in AA there's this idea of a higher power. I guess classically it was God, it was the higher power, but then to be more pluralistic or whatever, they talked about higher power. And some recognition that you have to go outside of samsara, outside of the mundane world of desire and clinging and the world to find our, to find some kind of solution to the addictive tendencies of the mind. Buddhist analysis of the human condition is that we're all addicted to some degree. If we weren't addicted to some degree, we wouldn't be cycling through on and on and on. And so to have some refuge or some reference to something which is outside of samsara, or some understanding that our ultimate happiness is not found in the world, or probably should be said more carefully, the world is not the problem. The ultimate happiness is not found in our attachments and our clinging to the world. The world is fine in itself, but we're not going to, but holding on to and clinging it to, into it, or running away from it, is not going to provide the answer. So the tendency in Buddhism, I believe, is to offer a view of mental practice, of spiritual practice, that is neither life-affirming or life-denying. It just simply doesn't play that game. What's focusing on is rather is no longer relating to the world through clinging or through aversion. So to find some way to step outside of this wandering on and on and on with the mind. And how do we do that? One way that Buddhists have done this is to take refuge. The idea of taking refuge in Buddha Dharma Sangha is the equivalent for Buddhists of, you know, taking refuge in a higher power. The refuge is that which pertains to the non-samsaric world, that which points to that which is beyond worldly attachments. Another way, which I found very powerful, and I think is a very simple kind of straightforward thing of cultivating concentration. That staying with the breath, for example, developing concentration, is a way of encouraging the mind to step out of its preoccupations, to be preoccupied in the cycles of thoughts and thoughts, and thinking things over and over and over again. It can be very hard. You know, there's a kind of an inner voice, perhaps, or kind of this intuition we have, perhaps, I don't know what the right word is, of thinking that the mind's going to solve its own problems. And certainly the mind can solve problems at times, but sometimes the mind kind of goes over and over and over and over and over again. And it's just a dead end to go over it. And sometimes you need a vacation to step out, to really see, get a perspective, to see truly what's going on. So taking a sabbatical, taking a vacation, for some people is very, very helpful. Because as long as you stayed in the situation that you were kind of wandering in, around and around and around in, you don't see the solution. So this, you can take a breather, for example. Go for a walk in nature. Same thing with developing concentration. To focus, to latch, to hook the mind, the energies of the mind, onto the breath or some other object of concentration, begin to take the energies of the mind away from fueling its preoccupations. And the more fully we can kind of throw ourselves into the world of concentration, the less we're fueling this world of preoccupations. And if you're convinced enough that it's not useful to keep thinking over and over and over again your problem, then you're more likely to put your attention on the breath. And as you do that, as the energy goes away from that thinking, you're not identifying with it, thinking it so much anymore. You're not fueling it so much anymore. And you get a better perspective of what that thinking is all about. You almost need to step outside of samsara to see what samsara is really like. You need to step outside of the momentum of a desire to see, oh, that's not who I am. I'm not my thoughts. I don't have to believe my thoughts. I don't have to be in their grip. And so maybe they don't go away, but they can certainly become softened unless they don't pull us around by the nose anymore, as can often be the case. So concentration is one way of helping us step outside of some of this momentum of the mind that we're cycling through. Another way is to practice seeing. Seeing or recognizing, very clear recognition of what happens when the recognition is really clear, is understood or can be a form of stepping outside of the very thing we're seeing. Stepping outside of it in terms of being caught by it. There's a way in which the psyche, when it very, very clearly sees what's happening, tends not to be caught by it. It's kind of like a magician's trick. You know, as long as you don't understand how the trick works, wow, that's fascinating. But once you kind of see how the trick works, you get bored pretty quickly. You're not caught by it anymore. To really see how the magic of the mind works, we tend not to kind of be caught by those things anymore. So seeing is another way of stepping outside. So that's one of the things we practice also in Vipassana, is learn to see clearly. Another way of stepping outside of the wheels of samsara is to have the experience of that part of the psyche, that part of the mind, which does not pertain to say it maybe a little bit differently, to have some sense of that part of the psyche which is independent of clinging and reverting to the things of the world. There's some aspect of the mind, some dimension of the psyche, some dimension of consciousness, some dimension of our being, some dimension of life, which is considered to be deathless. That's what we have written on the wall up there, the deathless dimension. That's part of the psyche which is independent or at peace with itself, without needing anything to fuel that peace or to create that peace. To back up a little bit, in the analysis of the Buddha of this process, the Buddhist analysis of this process of samsara, clinging is the ultimate fuel for the process of samsara. And the word for clinging here is upadana in Pali. And upadana has two meanings. It means clinging, and it also means fuel. And so it points to this dual nature, that the very act of clinging perpetuates further clinging, is a fuel for further clinging. That dimension of the psyche, which is at peace, that needs no fuel for its perpetuation, for its continuation, that needs nothing, is that dimension which in Buddhism is called nirvana or nibbana. It's that dimension of the psyche which doesn't wander anymore, doesn't run anymore. It's not running on and on and on, running after things. It's kind of like if someone I've used this analogy before. Say that you were born in the water, in the ocean. And we're born swimming. And all we're doing is swimming. And we're swimming and swimming and swimming. And all we do is swimming. We don't know any other option but swimming, swimming, swimming. And we've heard that there are these places you can go to, these islands, where maybe you can go up on the shore and the beach and kind of rest a little bit from all this swimming. But you keep swimming and looking for these islands, and you kind of see an oasis in the distance. Are there oases in the ocean? And you swim to it and it disappears when you get there. And you never quite find how to get there. And you're swimming on and on and on, and you're looking and looking, and you can't find anything. And you're so exhausted from this endless lifetimes of swimming and swimming and swimming. And finally, you just give up, and you flip over on your back, and lo and behold, you find out you can float. You didn't have to swim. The search was not about finding something out there, but the search was a flipping over of consciousness. So consciousness itself just rests and finds the peace that's possible here and now. So part of this process, then, is to be very respectful, very kind, in a sense very generous, to the samsaric aspect of our own minds, that part of our mind that flows on and on and on, and not to be engaged with it or relate to it in ways that just fuels further roaming around in samsara. If we hate our minds, we hate the momentum, the clingings, and the versions of our mind, we're just adding fuel to this fire that's burning. Can we meet ourselves with kindness? Can we meet ourselves with some level of non-interference, some level of non-violence, some level of, in a sense, it has to be okay. It's kind of an acceptance of this. And the seeing of our practice is part of this. Just to see. It's enough just to see it at times. One of the safest places to do that is in meditation. Because you're not going to act on what you see in your mind. what your mind does. You can just act, see it, and step outside of the cycles. And it's not an easy thing to do, and that's why I think it's very important to have this nonviolent approach, this peaceful approach to what you see there, and practice forgiveness, practice compassion, generosity to what we see. It's part of the path of becoming free. I think I just stepped off the wheel of the talk. So, does anybody have any comments or questions that they'd like to ask? Yes, please.
Hi, you're talking about if you live a certain way, you're reborn in another realm, perhaps. And then I take it that one moves out with some kind of life in that realm and then is reborn yet again based on what progress or lack thereof has occurred. Is that right? Is that the concept?
It's more or less a concept. No life that we're born into is permanent. So in Buddhism, just like in other religions, Buddhism has hells. I was a little bit disappointed when I heard this, the thing of even the hells in Buddhism are temporary. But temporary means can mean a really long time. You know, for practical purposes, it seems like eternity. But and also heavens are not eternal, but they can be a long time. But we tend not to create, my understanding is we tend not to create a lot of new karma in these other realms. We tend to create most of the new karma in the human realm. But then, in a sense, we're working out the karma. And when the karma is exhausted, then we either sink or rise. In these, you know, if we see these as being hierarchical, which sometimes is seen, with hells at the bottom of bad karma will cause you to sink down there, and when that bad karma is exhausted in a sense, then you float up a little bit. And good karma makes you float to the heavens, and then when that is exhausted, you tend to sink down. But karma, it doesn't exhaust itself in one lifetime. It isn't like you come back to neutral as a human being. You might go through cycles of, you know, being reborn in hell for a while or in animal realms for a while. It's considered, human life is considered very fortunate to be in because it's considered to be the best one to practice in. Spiritual practice is most conducive. Is most conducive to practice. It said, if you're born in the heavenly realms, that things are so pleasant, so wonderful, so blissful, that you're not interested in practice. And if you're born in the hell realms, you're suffering so much. You're blinded. You can't really see your way to practice. So in terms of this lifetime here, sometimes to be born in very fortunate circumstances where things are really pleasant, sometimes not really the best thing in terms of spiritual practice, as some of the Dharma teachers who teach in Hawaii have pointed out. People don't come to one-day sittings in Hawaii so much because they can go to the beach, which is a wonderful thing to do. Yes, please.
Constantly wherever you look, and everybody is doing it. It's kind of a real difficult thing to think that that's not normal.
Yes, so
this is the way of life, and that this is the way I'm supposed to behave, and I should just work to that so I can acquire all this. And you know, people have a real difficult time with the word discipline because it means I'm going to go without. They don't realize that. With discipline, you get to have yourself.
Yeah, very good. So you hear what she said? That it's very hard the environment. But if the environment is all about desire and consumption, and that appears as being normal, then it's very hard to step outside of that conditioning and that pressure from the society We think in order to be successful, the person who dies with the most toys dies the most successfully. And so we try to acquire. You said more. My mind is kind of stuffy.
The word discipline is weighted as going without, and it's very, very negative, and to be able to reach the levels that you're talking about and understand them, you need to have a certain amount of discipline to set the time aside to be able to understand these concepts and change yourself to become what you want to be.
So she said that the word discipline is taken negatively by some people because it seems like a kind of a denial. But actually, discipline is actually that thing, if you apply yourself, which leads you to that kind of freedom. And you need to be disciplined in order to find it. And another word that's similar to discipline is renunciation. To actually renounce seems very against this whole idea of me, myself, and mine having. But what you gain through the renunciation is you gain yourself, you gain your peace, you get this really wonderful thing. And so when society in general goes in a different direction, then it's very hard for us to be willing to kind of go against the current of society. That's always been the case. I mean, we think of modern Asian teachers who come to America and looked around and said, this is a culture of hungry ghosts. But, I think the Buddha talked about, in his time even, that the practice was going against the current, the popular currents of the time. And so if you're going against the popular currents, it's helpful to realize that's what you're doing and to find support in doing that. And some people finding like-minded people is very, very helpful. Otherwise, it's hard to stand against the flood by oneself. Yes, please. I don't know. I haven't studied this kind of thing so much. There's a whole cosmology in Buddhism that describes all these things. In the heavenly realms, there's many different heavenly realms, not just like one heaven. And so, depending on where you are and get reborn, the shape you have, the form you have, varies. The highest heavenly realms, there's no body at all. The beings are formless. So, and then as you get further down, I think it's more and more form. But generally, in depictions of it, in lower forms, like Brahma, who's the... Brahma is kind of like the highest god, the king of the gods, in the 33 lower heavenly realms. Right? There's more above that. And usually when he's usually depicted kind of like in anthropocentric forms or human form, kind of like, with two arms and two legs, two eyes. In hell realms, I think it's usually, I think generally the concept is, or the paintings that are made, it's usually like beings with two legs and two arms, and they kind of resemble human beings. But I don't know if there's any reason why it should be that way. It's kind of anthropocentric. Is it that when you die, are you getting reborn as a earthworm? Or are you an earthworm that's reborn as a human being? I mean, it's kind of arbitrary how we tend to focus everything from our perspective, that we're a human being, and so it's a human being that's getting reborn as an animal or as a god or all these different things. But it's the flow of consciousness which is taking these different forms, and the flow of consciousness sometimes takes the form of a human being, and then sometimes other forms. Is this responding to your question somewhat?
It is. I'm still visualize it.
Yeah.
I'm just still curious, like, is it here on Earth? Is it just consciousness here on this Earth? Is it...
Oh, what's the physical shape of it?
Yeah. What's the space like?
Oh, well, there's a very clear map that the classic Buddhism has of this. The world is flat, and the flat world is divided into four different continents, and the southern continent is Jambudvipa, which is the rose apple tree continent, which is basically India, And human beings live there. And the other continents, other kind of beings live in these other continents. And in the juncture of these four different continents in this flat world is a huge mountain called Mount Sumeru. And below Mount Sumeru, below this flat world, is these heavenly realms, kind of like an upside-down mountain. And then above Mount Sumeru, if you go up to the top of Mount Sumeru, you find these at the higher realms of the Mount Sumeru, which is equated somewhat with the Himalayas, you find the lower realms of the God realms, the realms of form. And then when you go above Mount Sumeru into the kind of the ether that's above there, then you find this more disembodied spirit kind of God realms above that. So that's kind of the image that you find paintings in Buddhism of that kind of depictions. And sometimes it's depicted kind of like an upside down like an hourglass. With the point of Mount Sumeru being the narrow end of the hourglass, and then the heavenly realms beyond that go this way, and then below that goes down to the heavenly realm, the hell realms below. So that's kind of the classic image. And it's been a little bit of a challenge to some Buddhists when they, say Tibetan Buddhists, for example, before 1959. Some of them lived fairly independent of Western views of the nature of the world. And so some Tibetan teachers, medicine monks, grew up with the notion that the world was flat. And it was a bit of a shock to find out that the world was not flat. There was one great story of a Tibetan teacher, monk, coming to the West, I think, in the early 60s, and being at some conference taking it for granted that the world was flat. And then the person who was writing about this said, I'm a geologist, and I had to kind of search through my mind. It's been a few hundred years since we had to kind of prove to anybody that the world was not flat, to give them the proof. But we explained to the person that in fact that the world is not flat, it's round. And the Tibetan teachers very calmly said, oh, that's nice. In the time of the Buddha, it was flat. And now it's no longer flat. Now it's round. So there's a classic, you know, cosmology, and then there's how we relate to it nowadays, and how we, it's kind of hard for people, And so for me personally, and it's just a very personal statement, is to me, I don't relate so much to the classic cosmology. It doesn't have much meaning for me. But this Buddhadasa form of interpretation of it, that it happens moment by moment in our own mind, that has a lot of meaning for me. That's what I find most useful. And the wonderful thing about it is that to step off the cycles of samsara, the endless wanderings of samsara, in the more literal sense of it, classically, off the cycles of rebirth, or to step off the endless cycles of the mind reborn moment by moment, is exactly the same practice, same process. So you do exactly the same practice both ways. So you're kind of covering your both bases. And so it doesn't really matter that much which one you believe in, as long as you do the practice. Okay? Yes, please.
Now having a different thought is, the fly that you squish could be someone. and I'm wondering if some of the non-harming came out of that, that there's this realization, if you really believe in rebirth, that this indeed could be you, or someone you knew, or a person being reborn in another form.
Certainly that view has existed. People have that view. Everyone's teaching is that everyone at some point or other has been your mother, or your father, or your grandmother, or your uncle, or your daughter, or your son. And so when you go around and see another person, it isn't just like a stranger. Like some point in this eternity of cycling, that person was probably your relative. So you kind of relate to them a little bit differently. Or this fly, you're right, this fly might have been.
But to take it a step further,
if we eat meat.
Who knows what we're eating and who it was.
Yes, please.
I have a question about the idea of discipline. I think I've had experiences where I feel like practicing discipline leads to a greater sense of freedom and contentment.
You're right.
But I think I've also had experiences where what I am thinking of practicing discipline actually leads to more sense of deprivation and more hunger.
Yes.
I was trying to figure out what would lead to one path versus the other, and I basically it's easy for me to think of it when you were talking about food. That is, there are times when I think that discipline with food allows a greater freedom, and that other times going for a long time without food actually makes me feel much more physically deprived and more hunger rather than feeling more sense of freedom or contentment.
Great question. So the question is about discipline, and is when is it that it's useful and helpful, and when is it that it actually is a form of deprivation that actually makes things worse for a person, right? And a small thing is we use our experience as being self-correcting. We learn from our consequences, and then we study that, and we feel, you know, that there's more suffering or more deprivation coming from it. Then maybe we do a course correction. We learn from that. And why can discipline be different, and one can be liberating, and one can be enslaving? Probably a lot of it has to do with our motivation behind it, and that's why in Buddhism we focus a lot on what is the motivation, and if the motivation is somehow egotistical, or fear-based, or greed-based, or clinging-based. Trying to create a better identity. You know, I'm gonna fast for 3 days so that because I believe that I don't know. There's all kinds of motivations built into why we do things. That if we pay attention to that motivation, we'll see. Oh, this is off. So that's what I encourage you to do is look at the motivation. Yes.
Gil, how would you hold the concept of will to live, which is a fairly biological force, and the desire or wish to escape from rebirth, particularly in view of your upcoming lectures on the Buddhist dealing with dying? Because in my experience, there's a problem there. But the will to live inherently is fighting against an acceptance of dying. How does Buddhism hold those?
This will probably be the last answer, so we'll stop. Some of you are leaving already, so you know we're coming to an end. Well, there has been the notion in Buddhism at various times that the will to live is something we can let go of. And if a person has if a person has cultivated themselves in such a way there's no more momentum in the mind, then it's actually you can just release that will. At some point, you can release that last little momentum of will, of live, and you can pass away. So the Buddha did that in a sense. He was asked, or he vowed, or promised to stay alive. He was asked to die. Mara came and asked him, you know, to die. And he said, no, I'm not going to die until I'm confident that this path that I want to teach is well established among human beings. And then when that was finally well established, then the Buddha, in a sense, let go of his will to live at the age of 80 or 81 years old. He was sick and frail, and he didn't hold on anymore. But he held on as long as he felt it was useful for him to be alive. You have many examples of great teachers in the past, great practitioners, who have sat in meditation or done walking meditation or something, and then basically let go of the will to live at a particular time and place, which felt appropriate. Not at all understood as being suicide, but it's understood to be you have so much power over the mind or that you know how to let go of even that. And you know, we see that sometimes. You know, you don't have to be a great adept, a spiritual adept. You see it, for example, in people who are dying, maybe in a hospital or something, and you get a sense that they are hanging in there until someone can fly in from out of town. And when that person finally flies in, then they kind of let go. They're holding on for something. And so I don't know if that at all addresses your question. Probably not. It's a little bit hard for me to think today. And my mind is a little bit stuffed up. Yes, another doctor.
Actually, it's a newspaper reader. As I understand it, the day after we entered the new millennium, statistically significant number of people died. The explanation was they just wanted to hold on at it.
I hope this has been useful. And mostly my intention in giving this talk was to encourage or inspire you to see if you can look at your own mind a little bit and study it and see if this idea of samsara, you can apply it to your own mind as a way that's helpful for you so you not get caught by it so much and find some freedom, peace with your own mind. And may you all remain human beings.